Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what drives destructive or unethical foreign policies? Some point to pathological beliefs and pursuits of exceptionalism, honor, and glory. Others point to systemic flaws. What are the consequences? Then on the Scholar Circle, our panel argues that warring is a relatively new phenomenon in human societies. We are speaking with Chris Fettweiss. He is a professor at Tulane University, and he studies political psychology and exceptionalism that drives nations to do stupid things. He presented at the APSA conference, and we're going to talk about what he has found in terms of the United States. Let's start with exceptionalism that you said drives countries to do things that are not so smart.
Every country feels exceptional in a lot of ways. The smallest country feels their culture is the best and they have figured everything out and everyone should adopt their ways. But a lot of people think America is exceptional in its exceptionalism, that we really think we have it figured out. And also we have greater power than most countries, so our exceptionalism allows us to do stupider things than other countries. Albanian exceptionalism isn't too dangerous to the rest of the world.
Talk about how this exceptionalism is articulated and then how it manifests itself in foreign policy.
One of the things it does is leads to its hubris, what the ancient Greeks used to talk about, excessive self-love and self-confidence. And it leads us to overestimate the capabilities that we have, that we think things that are impossible are just difficult, and anything is possible if we put our minds to it. It's the American way. We can do it. And it's an optimistic, good aspect of our national character, but it can lead to bad outcomes. Things like nation building in Afghanistan, for instance. We think it's just difficult. If we put our minds to it, we'll be able to do it, rather than what a cool-headed analysis might say, that this is going to be impossible. It also leads us to not really understand others, understand how others are going to react to what we do or how they're thinking. So we are constantly surprised, repeatedly surprised, when others don't react to our actions in the ways we think they're going to.
You argued that this is actually pathological.
Yeah, and pathological in the sense that it can be counterproductive. It leads to dumb things. It's part of a basket of different emotions or motivations that lead us to do stupid things. Like, we fear much more than other countries do. And I talk also about honor and glory, but hubris, this excessive self-image, leads us to do pathologically counterproductive actions.
I'm guessing you think the Iraq invasion would be one of those.
That's one of the prime stupid things that we've done. And a lot of my work is trying to figure out why exactly we did it. There's a lot of different theories out there, from neoconservative cabal to getting oil. I think it's just people made a fairly stupid decision because of beliefs that they brought into the decision.
So maybe while all these other factors may have come into play, say the oil or the neoconservatism or there's even the psychological issue with Bush and his father and all of that, maybe they are all present and it just takes this hubris, as you call it, to believe that they're going to be able to be successful.
Yeah, we underestimated the costs of what Iraq was likely to be. We also didn't understand how the Iraqis were likely to react. It turns out we were surprised they didn't like being conquered. And that came as a surprise to a lot of us. The people who were supporting the war were fairly flabbergasted by what came next, which has been 3 solid years of civil war and then simmering violence since. And that took us by surprise. It was a decision based on a set of beliefs that were pathologically incorrect, that we are in tremendous danger, for instance, and we had to get Saddam Hussein because somehow he was threatening the United States. That's crazy.
So that's really kind of more of a fear issue than a hubris issue.
Yeah, that's fear. They all come together, and there's other factors, too, that you had mentioned. These complex events are rarely monocausal. They have a lot of different factors going into them. But fear and hubris certainly played a role.
What about the honor and the glory that you were talking about?
Very few political scientists or political leaders today talk about honor, but they do worry a lot about credibility. And the credibility of the United States is at stake if we lose here, if we don't continue to fight. The way people talk about credibility today is much like most centuries have talked about honor. So it still matters, and it still leads us to do stupid things. Vietnam, for instance, you can't understand why we were in Vietnam without obsession with credibility of the United States and the credibility of our commitments. And there's a lot of political science evidence to suggest that credibility today doesn't help you in the events of tomorrow. If you think you're bolstering your credibility, but other people don't perceive it that way. They don't remember the last event to the extent that you think they will. When you do something to bolster your credibility, you're hoping it'll make future crises easier to handle. And that's usually not the case. So we do stupid things because of our credibility. And the glory part, today you can't have a president say, let's go attack the country for the glory of America. Luckily, Napoleon could do that, but President Obama can't do that. But he can talk about competitiveness. We're a competitive country. We want to be number one. We want to be the best, and by a lot of measures, we're the most competitive country. And worry obsessively about our prestige and national rank and status. Will China rise to be number one someday? What will the cost be? I think that that's a pathological concern to obsessively try to be the best. First of all, China's not rising in any real measurable way that can overtake the United States in a way that matters. And if we don't realize that being number one isn't maybe as important, we might do something stupid in the future to prevent China from being number one. We're in my circles, in security circles, when people talk about Chinese aircraft carriers, there's an element that freaks out, like the Chinese are going to hit the beach at San Diego and start working their way east. It's really not that much of a concern. And we're not in that much danger, and we shouldn't obsess about being number one and the glory that is the best. One of the big themes of all the Republicans is that President Obama doesn't love America sufficiently. He didn't wear a flag lapel pin for a few months into the first campaign. He doesn't love it enough. And they're going to outlove America and have people vote for him. And there's a certain part of the electorate likes that. They'll vote for the person who seems to love America more because we all sort of bask in the reflect glow. So if they're loving America, they love me too. And we're going to have decisions to make in the coming years about Iran and about China. And my hope is that we can make those decisions better by recognizing the pathological influences of fear, honor, glory, and hubris in what we usually do. If the wrong president comes into power or is surrounded by advisors who think we have to attack Iran because they're a threat, that would be, in my estimation, probably a really stupid decision. So hopefully we can prevent that from happening.
You mentioned that you also have looked at post-Iraq war. Mm-hmm. What did you find?
I talk in earlier work about what is likely to happen after Iraq. I said we're unlikely to have a victory or a defeat like on the battleship Missouri after World War II. There's unlikely to be a surrender. It's probably just going to be a petering out to low-level guerrilla war for a while, and we're going to have troops there probably for the rest of my lifetime. Maybe not in the same numbers we have today, but there'll be somebody there keeping an eye on al-Qaeda elements in Iraq. We've jammed our hand into a hornet's nest. And it's hard to rip it out without having the hornets spill out all over the place. So it was a much bigger operation than the original planners thought it would be. They thought we'd be greeted as liberators, people throwing flowers at us, so happy to be conquered, they couldn't get over it. Turns out they weren't. It turns out that we did the impossible. What seemed to be impossible made life in Iraq worse for the people of Iraq. It was bad under Saddam, but civil war is worse. And the hundreds of thousands, who knows how many casualties, how many people died. We made things worse, which was hard to do, because Saddam was a bad guy. There's no doubt about that. Was he a threat to us? No. Was he even a threat to his neighbors anymore? But he was a bad guy.
I'm curious if when you look across other nation states, ethnic groups, if you find this is comparable to other kind of pathologies, and if you found that it had any impact on the long-term well-being of a nation state, ethnic group.
A lot of people talk about Rome. And the fall of the British Empire, a lot of it fueled by fear of whatever group was right over the frontier. The British kept expanding because as soon as they expanded, they found another threat. And these kinds of pathologies can lead to overexpansion, overextension. I don't think it's a big danger for the United States, really. I don't think we're going to collapse in any way, because what really took down Rome was not hubris, but the barbarians. There's no barbarians going to storm into Washington, D.C. and burn it down anytime soon, which tells you we shouldn't be as fearful as we are, number one. But we're also not in the same danger of collapsing to outside enemy barbarians. We may experience its relative decline over this coming century, but it's not likely to be violent, likely to get better even for Americans over the course of the next century. Nobody talks about that.
Even with climate change?
Climate change, it's changing slowly. We'll see. That's sort of out of my field. In my field, people worry whether that'll lead to war and conflict over resources. It's much easier to cooperate over water than fight over it. Mm-hmm. And oil, it's very difficult to get oil out of a territory that's under dispute. Usually, and this is the case in the Caspian, the North Sea, all over, and it'll probably be the case in the South China Sea, they'll cut deals. They'll be posturing in the beginning, muscle flexing, and then they'll cut a deal where everybody gets a piece. Because if you don't cut a deal, you don't get the oil.
A lot of people would argue that much of what's gone on in Africa have been fighting over natural resources and some multinational corporations going and exploiting those natural resources and labor. And then you've seen in the Middle East, for example, a lot of warring over water, where the line goes, so who has access to the water.
In Africa, certainly, is by these sort of criminal gangs in West Africa and in the Congo that try to gain control of mineral-rich territory. There's been talk about water wars in the Middle East since I was a teenager, but they found ways to cooperate, because if they don't, don't, over the Nile or in the Levant, or if they don't figure out ways to come to agreements, then no one's going to be able to use the water. It's easy enough to prevent that from happening, to blow dams and or poison wells. It's so far, and I think there's a reason to be optimistic, that over natural resources, it's better to cut deals than fight for them. And I think most leaders in the end realize that. They'll posture and threaten, but they're not going to fight. And the Caspian Sea, you know, throughout the 90s, people said there's going to be war because they'll never be able to figure out how to cut up the Caspian Sea and share those resources. And there was some muscle flexing occasionally, but they now have deals and the oil's flowing out of there. And what's likely to happen, I think, with water resources is, as the climate evolves, and oil too.
I think this was you that said this about how this was actually a more peaceful time than before. And I was recalling scholars calling the 20th century the mass murder century. So I was trying to reconcile the difference there between the way you saw it and if you were just an eternal optimist or if there were real numbers to measure this out.
There's a lot of real numbers, especially since the end of the Cold War. There's a few operations, outfits that measure and count wars. They all find that the number and intensity of wars has dropped steadily since the end of the Cold War. Nobody notices this. Internal wars, external wars, interstate wars, civil wars, ethnic conflicts.
Because we've had two essential genocides since then, too. I mean, Bosnia and Rwanda. Mm-hmm.
If you go back throughout history and measure the wars and the genocides, the major human rights violations, they're less frequent than they used to be. They still happen. There's still problems. I'm not saying there's not going to be trouble in the future. But there's less trouble with far more people than ever before. There's far fewer wars that happen now. There's no war going on in the entire Western Hemisphere, except Colombia's got a civil war and they're going on, but it's half the size it was 10 years ago. The entire Pacific Rim, all of Europe, completely at peace. But they just focus on the bad things, the potential for war. And Africa is a more peaceful place than any time we have in recorded history about it. It doesn't seem that way, because everybody knows about the Congo. It's still simmering in some places. West Africa is calm, which is hardly ever in history that there's no somebody's not killing somebody in West Africa. And maybe it's a temporary phenomenon in a few hours. When we get done with this interview, all hell's broken loose everywhere. But for now, it's peaceful. Nobody notices or cares when you tell them. Because when you tell them this, they say, well, yeah, but what about, you know, global warming? What about AIDS? Well, yeah, we got problems. And we, especially the United States, shouldn't be afraid. Because we're in a system, a global system, that is becoming more peaceful. And there's a lot of discussion about why. And that's a different book of mine about why it's happening. I think it's an evolution in ideas. Other people think other things. But maybe it'll reverse itself. Maybe not.
Does the outfit that counts wars include all of the, you know, the United States helping the Libyan?
Yeah, that would count. Nowadays, there's one outfit that says once a war has started, they keep counting it if it's 25 casualties a year. 25 casualties a year is a month in New Orleans. Most people who count, say, 1,000 battle deaths a year, you got a war going on. And by that standard, Libya counts, but it's hard to tell how many people have died. The Russia-Georgia business does not, 800 or so. People died. Even if you ratchet it down a bit, the numbers of wars are historically low because in the past, there was a lot more. There have been a lot more than were counted originally because during the Cold War, there was fighting everywhere constantly. And now, I mean, think about the numbers of wars that happened in the Western Hemisphere alone. Now they're all settled except Colombia, and that's sort of now a trafficking war.
Thank you so much for being with us, Chris Fettweiss. Chris Fettweiss is a professor at Tulane University, has two books out now and one forthcoming. What's the forthcoming one?
Called Pathologies of Power, Fear, Honor, Glory, and Hubris in U.S. Foreign Policy.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
With us is Camilo Mora, professor of geography at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Professor Mora and his colleagues have calculated how climate change will affect our temperatures around the year 2047. In the future, they found, our coldest year will be warmer than the past's hottest years. The changes, which will first occur in the tropics, are already driving some 25,000 species to extinction each year. Here's what Professor Mora had to say.
There is a massive heat wave in India where people is dying from this heat wave. The temperature is just exceeding what most people can tolerate. Now we can go somewhere else around the world. You know, right now in Colombia, last year alone, there was a massive drought there in which 6 months didn't rain at all. This is something that we're not used to. my grandfather and I had never seen something like this. And of course, what happened was then that the animals start dying because there was just no sufficient water for them. We have situations happening in Africa. You go to Africa, you see people close to die of starvation. Most social scientists will tell you that this is a problem of the redistribution of money around the world. But what I can tell you right now is that these people were used to live on those places sustainably. Right now, their environments are so impacted that they cannot provide the minimum resources to support that people. That's why you have so many people in Africa right now starving to death. Of course, if they were to have help from the developed world, that would be fantastic. But basically, those ecosystems have been impaired in the capacity to produce what these people need. And those are just some of the few examples that you can point out around the world where climate change is already becoming evident. And according to the analysis that we published last year, this will start happening very soon, and most places will be added to these events of very extreme climate conditions.
After we move from the tropics, other areas will start to be affected. It's all interconnected. Where do you see it moving next?
One of the things that will happen is that, of course, it's getting warmer on the tropics, and now suitable temperatures will start happening at mid-latitudes, and you will probably start seeing some migrations of species towards more suitable habitats at higher latitudes, again, just because the conditions there will become suitable for them. Many species, unfortunately, especially species that live on islands like here in Hawaii or there in New Zealand, these species will not have the chance of moving. So those species will have to try to adapt to the new conditions, to the new climates. Unfortunately, these changes are happening just too fast for them, and these species have never seen changes like this. So it's very likely that most species just will not have the capacity to adapt to these changes, which will leave a third option for them, which is to go extinct. Entire ecosystems like coral reefs, for instance, could be completely transformed because many species there will not be able to withstand the higher temperatures that we are already seeing, actually. So that's what will happen in mid-latitudes. So some species will start moving towards there, but there's going to be a point in which you are going to run out of space, really, where you can find suitable climates. Again, in the paper that we published, we found that the average location on the whole planet will have completely new temperatures by the middle of this century. By around 2050, the average location on this planet will have conditions that we have never seen in the last 200 years.
There was a New York Times article in which you were cited, and they talked about your report, or about your paper that was published in Nature. And there were certain areas that people would need to move toward for livability. It sounded like the Canadian zone would be okay. It sounds like that sort of northern part is okay. Is that going to be the new habitability?
Well, there are two ways to deal with these changes in the climate. One is to adapt. See, many people will not have the chance of moving. I mean, it's not like a Colombian like me can go and move to Canada. There's just no way they let me cross that border. So right now, given the geopolitical distribution of this planet, most of the world's human population will not be able to move. So these people will have to adapt to whatever is coming to them. I mean, you can imagine, if they had no capacity to adapt, imagine the political instability that that will generate on many of these tropical countries. Some other people, especially the rich countries, they probably will have the chance of moving towards more suitable conditions. So we're talking two potential different responses there. One is adaptation, and the other one is moving. And I think that the developing world is limited on those choices.
One of the other issues that is supposed to arise from climate change pertains to the sea level rises. And some countries are so close to sea level that there's a concern they may be completely drowned out. Some of them are in the global south, like Tuvalu and Kiribati. What are we facing with these countries?
That is one of the most worrisome consequences of climate change. That's a very good example. See, when we think about climate change, most people often think about just temperature, but there are multiple other related variables that will change as a result of the increasing addition of greenhouse gases. One of them is sea level. Sea level will increase through two different mechanisms. One of them is through the expansion of the water as the oceans get warmer. If you increase the temperature, the water is just going to expand, and that contributes a lot to sea level rise. And the other one is the melting of the sea ice. So those two factors together are going to increase the sea level quite a lot. And for many of places, it's going to be completely devastating, especially those islands that are only 1 or 2 meters above sea level. Entire countries could disappear. However, the impact of this is also going to be seen in developed countries. Right now, for instance, here in the United States, the most expensive houses are often located by the ocean. Here in Hawaii, I mean, a house by the ocean can cost anything between $1 million and $10 million. And it turns out that every time that there is a major flood, all of those houses get inundated with water. So here we are very concerned with sea level rise, especially because those are the most expensive properties right now. So this is a concern, the sea level rise, for many insurance companies nowadays, just because, again, there's just too much money at stake when it comes to sea level rise.
When it comes to issues like biodiversity, you used a phrase, double jeopardy, and you said that has not been really accounted for in previous studies. How does this come into play?
Well, it comes from the sense that species will be impacted through different aspects of the biology of these species will impact those species dramatically. So, for instance, one of them, as I point out to you, is the capacity to move. So many species will not have that chance. So they will be restricted in the way that they can cope with climate change. And the other one is the degree of adaptation. As I point out to you before, one of the problems there is that many species just most likely are not going to have that capacity. They have been living on environments that have been so stable that it's very easy for the climate to exceed what these species can tolerate.
There are other factors such as disease that scientists are saying they're going to spread faster. And that would be another factor that would then add to this sort of double jeopardy factor. How do you see that in the process through the regions that you've studied?
The general goal of the research that we are doing here is on the status of biodiversity. And the main pattern there is that we are losing species like nobody's business. Every year we are driving to extinction on the order of 25,000 species. Every year, we wipe out from the surface of the planet 25,000 species. These are the species that you will never see again. Now, why is that happening? So one of the major components of our research is to identify the drivers of that loss. And we, of course, identify climate change as perhaps one of the top driver of biodiversity loss. But there are multiple other factors at play. We had overexploitation. We had habitat loss. Every year, we are cutting on the order of 10 million hectares of forest. You know, here in Hawaii, as an example, we only left 14% on the native forest. I did have the fortune of living in New Zealand. And for instance, the Northern Island, I mean, it's amazing. I didn't see trees there. You know, every time that I was in New Zealand, I was always wondering how that ecosystem was used to be before. So there are multiple other factors that are impacting these species as well. Now, the concern for me as a scientist is that biodiversity is a very unique attribute of this planet. There is no other planet that we know has life. So it's not like we can go some other planet and replace these species. Once they are gone, they are gone. And it's not like we had the chance of going somewhere else once we screwed up this planet. If we damage this planet, we're going to be stuck with it. So, again, all of these consequences of the way in which we are impacting our planet.
And then losing 25,000 species a year then impacts the remaining species, does it not?
Well, to be honest with you, the situation is so sad that the species, even if some species that have been depleted quite a lot, even if you stop the driver of the decline, some of the species, instead of recovering, they actually keep going down. They kill themselves. It's something that is called ecological suicide. So we had impacted this species so much, and at some point, some people recognize that this is happening, and they stop doing that thing. But unfortunately, by that time, it's so late that the species itself will drive to extinction. So how this happens? There are three different mechanisms there. One is that the individuals that are left are so few that now they cannot.
We were just talking about the concept of ecological suicide and how that impacts the other species. So can you talk to us again about ecological suicide and its impact?
Yeah, so basically the ecological suicide is the situation in which a species get to be so depleted in which even after you remove an stressor, say that the cause of the decline is overfishing, and somehow a government say we are fishing this species too much, we are going to close these fisheries. What you will expect is that this population will recover. Because you are removing what is making the population sick, you will think that the species will recover. It turns out that it has been found that in many cases, the species, instead of getting better, is actually getting worse. And it triggers a process that is called ecological suicide, in which the species actually drives itself to extinction. There are different mechanisms that have been found to explain this. One is the fact that the individuals that are left are so rare now that they don't find each other, so they cannot reproduce. That is a phenomenon that is called a Lee effect. The other mechanism is through loss of genetic diversity. When you have depleted that population so much, there is not really too much genetic diversity on that population, and a single disturbance that might happen by chance alone can wipe out the species itself. So those are two of the mechanisms that will explain that. And the third mechanism is that since there are so few individuals left, sometimes they start reproducing with each other, like sisters with brothers, brothers with mothers, and all of these things, and that generates a problem that is called inbreeding depression. And that's basically the genetic fallout of reproducing with close relatives. And of course, that will happen if you only leave a few individuals left in the wild. I mean, there is no other chance than for them to reproduce. So those are some of the mechanisms in which the species will drive to extinction. Now, once the species is gone, there is another fallout from that, which is called co-extinction. And that is that certain cases, many of these species were fundamental for other species. So as soon as this species is gone, all of the species that were dependent on that species are likely to go extinct as well. And that has been documented. There is a couple of papers on that in the journal Nature talking about what they define as co-extinction. That is not that we are causing the extinction of those species, but indirectly they are being driven to extinction by or impact on other species.
Now, your paper looked at these impacts across the world if we left things as the status quo. Is that right?
We actually did two analyses on that paper. We analyzed what will happen if we don't do anything. And what we found is that under those conditions, the climate of the planet could move to a completely new state by sometime by the middle of this century, 2050 plus or minus a few years there. And that could potentially impact 5 billion people. Today, we will have 5 billion people that could be impacted by this climate change if we don't do anything by the year 2050. Now, another scenario that we analyze is, okay, let's see what happens if we take rapid action in reducing the emission of greenhouse gases. This is if we start reducing CO2 emissions by tomorrow. And what we were expecting was to find that the climate will perhaps stabilize, and what we found is that it does not. In fact, all what it does, this massive investment on reducing greenhouse gases, all what it will do is to slow down the change that is to come. And that just to tell you really the sad state of affairs of what we are doing with our planet.
So this is not really reversible at this point. Do you think it's inevitable?
The change in the climate is just not going to be stopped. And that is something that is called the inertia. So imagine, like, for instance, you are driving a car at 100 kilometers per hour and you stop the car, right? You stop the motor. The motor is what is pushing the car. And you will think that the car will stop right away because the motor is not pushing the car anymore. So what happens is that the car will still move a few meters more after you stop the car. That's because of the inertia of the car. It will move the car forward, even if there is nothing pushing the car. And that's what will happen with the climate as well. So even if we stop climate change today, this climate change is most likely going to keep going for a while. How far? Well, that's unfortunately something that we just don't know yet. But, do you really want to find that out later? This is just one of the decisions that we are faced with today. Is that, in my opinion, I don't think we should test any of these theories. We just don't mess with the climate.
One of the things that you mentioned to me was that you come from a farming family. And that's one of the issues that you also looked at was food and food production and what's going to happen in terms of feeding a planet under these conditions. What do you expect?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the other situation as well, is that most of the action to reduce greenhouse gases has to come from the first world. And unfortunately, we are the people that is perhaps going to be the less impacted by this and that will have the most capacity to adapt to these changes. However, what is happening is that we are leaving half of the world's human population at danger from this situation. And unfortunately, since we are not connected, that doesn't mean anything to us. But for people in the first world, we're talking about their livelihoods, their jobs, their food. Unfortunately, I don't think we had that kind of awareness yet. And even among the scientists, you know, we sometimes find these massive discoveries that really are impacting the planet. And I don't think that means much even for some of us as a scientist. I think that really for you to get a feeling of this, you need to go and live on the places that are being impacted right now for climate change. And I'm telling you that you will change your mind about how serious this is.
Camilo Mora, I would like to thank you so much for being with us here in the Scholar Circle.
It is my pleasure. Thank you very much, Maria, for inviting me.
When we come back, our panel argues that warring is a relatively new phenomenon in human society. Stay tuned.
And if I say to you tomorrow, take my hand, child, come with me. It's to a castle I will take you. Well, what's to be, they say, will be. And if the wind sees fin, sail away, leave the day way up high in the sky. And warm, but the wind won't blow. We really shouldn't go, it only goes to show.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. George Orwell wrote about a time of perpetual war for perpetual peace. And war has defined eras and played a central role in our politics and culture. But our next panel argues that warring is not the norm, that it may be a relatively new phenomenon, and that human beings are not warlike by nature. Their research is part of the book War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views. Douglas Fry is Director of Peace Mediation and Conflict Research at Abo Akademi University in Finland and Research Scientist at the University of Arizona. He's the author of Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace, and the editor of War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views. Darshan Narvaez is professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota and co-author of numerous books, including Evolution, Early Experience in Human Development, and Personality, Identity, and Character, Explorations in Moral Psychology. R. Brian Ferguson is professor of anthropology at Rutgers University, and he is author of numerous publications such as Full Spectrum, The Military Invasion of Anthropology, Born to Live, Challenging Killer Myths, and Yanomami Warfare, A Political History. Thank you so much for being with us. All three of you argue that war is really not the norm and that we're not warlike by nature. So let's start with the broad strokes of what and where the evidence is. Doug Fry, let's start with you. You've been studying peaceful societies. Who are they and what do they tell us about humanity?
There are peaceful societies, both internally peaceful, meaning that there's not much violence in the societies, and usually they have an ethic of nonviolence. But for this topic, we're more interested in the non-warring societies. If you look at the cross-cultural database, most societies do engage in war, but some do not. So the basic sort of ground argument here is that if some don't, it's certainly not something that's programmed rigidly into humanity's genes. But for this book, War, Peace, and Human Nature, I sort of take a new slant on this and consider the whole idea of restraint. And I'm talking about restraint against physical aggression, and try to contextualize the human animal within the primate order and also within other animal species. And the key idea there, we do an awful lot of avoiding of conflict, period, and sometimes we get into our verbal fights, and we could call those displays, analogous to displays in other animals, but rather very little of our conflict behavior actually involves anything physical at all. And this is just something that we all take for granted all the time. We don't expect to be hit as we just go around our lives, generally. We don't expect to be killed or kill anybody. We're really actually a pretty docile species, as are most other primates.
So what you're saying is really it's an anomaly to be physically violent, particularly lethally violent.
Yeah, particularly lethally violent. And here, of course, we're talking about everything, homicide and so forth. We calculate homicide rates in 100,000 per year. And they can range from virtually nothing, less than one per 100,000 per year, up to a so-called high homicide rate of 50 per year. A statistic I came across recently was if you add up during the World War II years in Europe, all of the domestic homicides plus all of the war deaths, it's somewhere in the range of about 500 per year per 100,000, which is like half of 1% of the population being killed during World War II in Europe. So, I mean, even under these extreme situations, that's not a high rate of killing just numerically. course, this is tragic for all the people who lost their lives and their loved ones. I don't mean to minimize it in any way. But again, I'm just trying to take a slant on this, which really goes in the face of the types of theories we hear all the time in the popular media that we're killer apes and that killing is in our genes and warfare is natural. We've always had war, always will have war. I really don't think the data shows that at all.
You did mention our closest species, the chimpanzees and the bonobos, and you wrote about them a little bit in the book, and you noted that one is a little bit more aggressive while the other isn't. How does it relate to what we're talking about here?
The bonobos and chimpanzees and humans are basically the three apes, you know, including humans as an honorary ape. We're all equally related to each other, but we're all different species. So we do have our own particular evolutionary trajectories, if you will. Chimpanzees tend to be more dominant and more aggressive. But the idea is we can't really use either one of those species just in of itself as some sort of model for human. My position is that we should look at our own species and how we behave, have some general frame of reference. Bonobos are rather unaggressive. Chimpanzees have been shown to kill members of other groups in the wild and in captivity. All of this emphasis has been placed, again, in popular press as well as with some colleagues on chimpanzees as being the species to look to try to get insights about human nature. And I really question that. We're obviously unique. So obviously, amongst our closest relatives, we have an ability to be lethally aggressive, and the other species, the bonobos, don't do this. So here we are humans. Yeah, we sometimes do this, but most of the time, actually, we don't do it either. So this is where my studies of hunter-gatherers comes in. If you take a cross sample, a sample of these basic, most archaic type of human societies we spent our human existence in for most of our species past, some of those groups are somewhat aggressive in terms of homicides and so forth. Others are extremely peaceful. So this brings us sort of full circle to your first question about peaceful societies. It's very possible to live without war, without feuding, with very low homicide rates. And in fact, my numbers show that about 29% of the sample of nomadic hunter-gatherers have very low homicide rates and do not engage in war. And if we just are looking at warfare, it's 62% of this sample that I deal with do not engage in warfare. So this sort of is a criticism of this assumption that, yes, whack in the past, there was warfare, and this is in our nature.
Brian Ferguson, you've also said that this idea of human nature being warlike is empirically unsupportable.
Right. I'll start by responding to the idea about chimpanzees and bonobos. This is a work in progress, and my view is that the difference between chimpanzees and bonobos in terms of the intergroup relations and aggressiveness is not as different as, in an inborn sense, as people have thought it to be. There are differences. These two species have been separated by about 2.5 million years of evolution, so there could be hormonal differences that affect their aggressiveness. But when you look carefully at the record about both of these species, you find examples of chimpanzees, especially in some of the very early observations that were done by Jane Goodall at Gombe, two different chimpanzee groups meeting in ways that is virtually indistinguishable from the way bonobo groups have been observed to meet. On the other hand, you have bonobo groups that, although there is not any recorded case of a lethal encounter between two groups, there is a lot of antagonism and sometimes actual physical fighting. There's real differences in the basic female bonding orientation of bonobos, where among chimpanzees, females don't bond to the same degree, at least in most cases, although some of them do. So there is a real difference there, but is it something that's built into their genes, hardwired, or is this a result of long-term adaptive changes associated with different kinds of ecologies? And what I emphasize in my work, the specifics of how human behavior has impacted on their environments, which has been different for bonobos than it's been for some chimpanzee groups.
The other aspect of this notion that war is human nature is empirically unsupportable.
Right.
You actually started with that quote that Barack Obama gave when he took his Nobel Peace Prize, that war in one form or another appears with the first man. You say that's not true. Why?
Well, it's not true. It's a common belief. Everybody, quote, knows it's true. It's a projection, modern-day conditions. This has been taken to an intellectual level most recently by Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker, in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, draws on two other researchers, Lawrence Keeley and Bowles, and also by LeBlanc. These are people who have written about the antiquity of war, and comes up with a list that supposedly demonstrates that among what they call prehistoric populations, that the average is 15% of the population dies in war, and a quarter of more of the men die in war. And this is the average. The research I've done, I've gone through the cases that they use for this, and there's a lot of problems with what I call Pinker's List. He, for example, counts some cases twice, and he counts three cases where there's one individual who's dead by violence as a case of war, and just can't do that because homicide could be the explanation. The ones that are valid examples of multiple deaths where you can really say there's at least two people here who've been killed, seeming to indicate war, that these are cherry-picked cases. These are exceptional cases. They do not represent prehistoric people, often from their very violent periods and times, and sometimes within the violent periods and times, they stand out as the most violent of all. So the alternative method of dealing with this is to look at the total archaeological record, which I've done. I've done for North America, I've done for Europe, and I've done for the Near East. And all of the cases that appear in Pinker's List, they're all covered there, but they're put in context. And when you put them in context, what you see is this. The very earliest records we have, the very earliest archaeological remains, which aren't much, we've got maybe 100 pieces of skeletal remains from Paleolithic Europe, that there is one instance of what looks like a violent death of a child. When you come forward in time in this period that's known as the Mesolithic, which is before agriculture, but when you generally had larger populations and more complex societies, then you begin to get in some places, but not others, good signs of war. So it precedes agriculture, but it's very sporadic. And in some places where you have it, later on in the same place you don't have it. When you get to agriculture, just leave it with Europe and the Near East because North America is more complicated. In most places, there's a period that ranges from 500 years to 1,500 years where you don't see evidence of war, and then gradually the signs of war begin to appear and become more unmistakable and more developed, more intense. And it's evident, it's obvious. And this is not, as I am often challenged, a case of absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. In other words, people say, because you don't find evidence of war, doesn't mean there wasn't any war there. It means you just haven't found the evidence. War leaves behind lots of archaeologically recoverable traces. And in the archaeological record, there is tons and tons and tons of irrefutable evidence of war out there. What I'm talking about is situations where you've got good archaeological evidence going over very long periods of time. No evidence of war in the earlier phases, good evidence of war in the later phases, without any kind of sharp increase in the recovery. In other words, the amount of material we're getting that could show war isn't getting any better. What's happening is the evidence of war is showing up. And the reasonable inference from that is that war has begun in those areas.
Darsha Navayas, you've looked at the cultural aspect and you've compared, say, Western culture with other cultures. What have you found?
Let me just say a few words about the culture that emerged among foraging nomadic bands. It's quite different than what we normally hear from Steven Pinker and others. For example, they really have a companionship culture from the moment of birth on. Every individual in the society is considered part of the self, more of a common self orientation. Animals and other entities are part of that common self, so they have a great respect for the environment, typically. There's a high sense of individualism. People are not coerced into any kind of behavior, even children, and yet they have a great sense of collective group identity in the group that they're in at the time. But they shift in and out of groups, and they're related to others in other groups nearby. They also seem to have a sustainable orientation to life in living as they go from feeding ground to feeding ground nomadically. They do not use up all the resources because they know they're going to have to come back in the next cycle. And they're very cooperative across groups. And there are other characteristics too, but let me just say that one of the key areas that we have changed from that lifestyle is how we raise children. And my colleagues and I are studying what we call the evolved developmental niche. And this is the caregiving context that our bodies and brains developed to need in relation to the maturational schedule of a baby, for example. And every animal has this developmental niche for their offspring, especially humans, because we're born so young with only 25% of the brain in place at birth, full-term birth. And these practices are all now related to health outcomes and well-being outcomes, and my lab is looking at moral outcomes and how they affect moral development in young children. These characteristics include breastfeeding extensively, 2 to 5 years among hunter-gatherer groups. And breast milk, we know, populates the gut with all the proper probiotic bacteria that lead to lifelong health and has all the immunoglobulins for the immune system to develop. And that takes a while, takes many years to develop that. That's why the breastfeeding lengths in part are so long. Another characteristic is touch. Children are held, carried, and slept with all the time when they're young. And that touch is known to help development as well and growth and all sorts of things, calmness. Another one is the responsiveness to the needs of the baby. You don't let babies cry it out, which is quite popular at the moment now. We know that has all sorts of poor effects on children's development in many ways. Another one is free play. Babies are ready to play almost from the day they're born to have a companionship care. Another one is multiple adult caregivers. Moms and dads can't do this alone. Babies need a lot of attention, and 50% of the time in some of these foraging bands, other adults were taking care of the baby, not mother. And then finally, natural childbirth, not in separating mom and baby or interfering with the timing of birth. And we've kind of gone against all these practices in the U.S. in the 20th century. And we're finding that each of these matter for moral development, three-year-olds, empathy development, conscience, self-regulation, and so forth. What happens when you don't have this early care, this evolved developmental niche, your brain systems for self-regulation are undermined. The vagal nerve, for example, doesn't get set properly, and that's related to calming yourself for social relationships, the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that is related to stress response is also misset up. And those things make you stress reactive. And when you're stress reactive, it shuts down the blood flow to the higher order thinking, the neocortex. It shuts down or it decreases compassion. And so you're more likely to be more aggressive.
It kind of leads into where I wanted to go here, which is if, in fact, what your work says is true, which is that war developed and was not necessarily with the first man, as Barack Obama had said, how did we get here? Doug Fry, would you like to start on that?
Basically, it's a social organization feature as I see it. Darsha was talking a bit about the nomadic hunter-gatherers. It's just such a different lifestyle than we're living today in our modern nation states with these populations of, you know, zillions of people that we see every day. It's a little hard, I think, for us in the 21st century to conceptualize just how far we have come, for better or for worse. But Darsha is pointing out that there are many things that were out of touch, I would say, with the way that our species has evolved, and therefore some of our critical needs for morality as well as a whole variety of other behaviors. So we're coming from a situation where basically there was a lot of restraint on the aggression. And the other aspect of the hunter-gatherer type of lifestyle that we're coming from is the disputes tended to be very personal. The disputes are more often than not over a woman, or if someone has been insulted in some way, there's been a theft or something like this. Most of the disputes are actually not lethal. But the idea that there would be a group versus group warfare just doesn't make any sense in terms of the way that the societies are organized. You want to develop friendships, and they do. You want to have connections across group lines. You may need to go over to a neighboring area where there are resources when you don't have those resources. For instance, if there's a drought, you need to move around and have free access to different areas. So some of these ideas that we get in our modern nation states that there are boundaries and that we would defend these borders and we keep people out. Another one is the whole idea of scarcity, a scramble for resources. In fact, the nomadic hunter-gatherers, they share. They're just sharing like crazy within the group and amongst groups. So basically a model that is emerging here is our natural tendencies are to be cooperative, to be sharing, to be very social, like to interact, get positive rewards from interacting in a pro-social way, which is most of social life. I mean, how could it be any different? So the warfare is something that has come rather recently as we've had increase in population and complex social organizations and especially a shift towards a social hierarchy. Here's yet another feature. These nomadic bands, they tend to be very egalitarian. Males and females are not in a strict hierarchy. Females are doing gathering for the most part, but not exclusively. Males are doing the hunting, but they don't interfere with each other. People get along well. I don't want to oversell this. Of course, there's conflicts and disputes, but they're dealt with through discussion or in sometimes contests. But the point is, the overall pattern is that people need other people, and therefore they're sharing, they're cooperating, they need to do this. And actually, I think there's a real important parallel for our 21st century. We need each other on this planet today. We're very much interlinked with our economies, and especially with global warming, and it's very analogous to the hunter-gatherer band out there in the environment, where you need the people in the next band over. You don't want to go and kill them. Why would you do that anyway? But on our planet today, we are interdependent in some of the same ways that our ancestors have been, and I actually see this as a good reason for hope, that we are really good cooperators. And if we can just manage to get our vision on this, that, oh, okay, we're on the same planet, we're facing very dangerous situations, there's many serious challenges, it's just foolish to get involved with more wars and fight with each other. We really need to work together.
I wanted you to just touch on the development of the nation state and how that affected war in general, but also power and insecurity.
We tend to live in the present and just take for granted that it's always been this way because it's this way now. Nation states are just a few hundred years old, actually. And Charles Darwin talks about the tribes have been able to come together and identify with each other. And then even he's thinking of England, you know, in the 1800s. You have some identity at the nation level at this point. So there's really no reason why then the different races, the different religions, and the different nations could come to a higher identity. And I think actually we're well on the path to that. So you have the nationalism, but at the same time, in the 21st century, you do have emerging higher level of identity with humanity overall. Humans are very flexible, so we can identify at different levels, and we can identify at different levels simultaneously. I like to call it expanding the us. There's the us and the them, but who is the us and the them? We're flexible with this. So there didn't used to be nation states. Now we identify with that. So it's just moved to another level of social evolution here, expand the us to the whole planet, and understand that like our hunter-gatherer ancestors, we need to work together to solve these problems, not fight it out, as we've become accustomed to doing in recent history.
I also think we should go back to a worldview that hunter-gatherers had in the past, and those extant often do today, and that is the sense that the other animals on the planet and other life forms and entities are part of us, and that we are all part of a common self, because we've lost that notion, and that's helping us to easily destroy our habitat now. And if we don't turn back very quickly and soon, we are going to lose ourselves as well.
Brian Ferguson, you've also written about the preconditions of peace.
Right. Your question, how did we get here with all the war? If I'm saying there's a time without war, well, that's obviously long ago. And you can look at that different ways. How do we get to the modern world we live in here in the United States? Or why is it that among tribal peoples we see around the world today, there's so much war? That's undeniable. And I'm saying that those tribal peoples are not the way archaeology says tribal peoples were 10,000 years ago. So why the change? I've written about what I call preconditions for war. These are social conditions which together make the onset of war more likely. And there's a whole list of them, such as leading a more sedentary or settled down existence, or concentrated resources, higher population density, the existence of social and political hierarchy. When I look at modern wars, the focus is always on the political leaders. That's where I think you have to look for understanding modern wars. But these things develop and they make the onset of war more likely. And these preconditions have gotten more common all over the world over time, over the millennia, which is one reason why war has become so common on planet Earth. But it's not the whole story. There are also preconditions for peace. And these include other social patterns, patterns of cooperation between different groups, of exchange and trade and intermarriage between different groups, recognized mechanisms of conflict resolution that people can go to, valorization, making valuable peaceful ideals. These things make the onset of war less likely. One of the most fascinating things I found in recent research I did for Doug's book was that one area of the Near East would seem to be very exceptional. It's an area called the Southern Levant. This is the Eastern Mediterranean, basically Lebanon, Jordan, parts of Israel, parts of southern Syria. It's an area where plants and animals were first domesticated. We've got excellent archaeological recovery from the area going back to 13,000 years ago. And one of the things that's truly remarkable is that when you look at the other areas of the Near East, like in Turkey or in the northern Tigris area, which is the area that I believe war began in, or look at Europe, you find evidence of war beginning 6,000 years ago, sometimes earlier, certainly within a few thousand years of the onset of agriculture. In the southern Levant, although there are a couple of suspected cases, there's one site that was burned over, and it could have been from an attack, but it could have been from something else. There's a period of about 10,000 years, from about 13,000 B.C. to 3,000 B.C., where there is not one unambiguous case where you can look at it and say, there is war. And you can do that for everywhere else, multiple times. And my inference from this, and looking at other aspects of these preconditions for peace, is that those people who first domesticated nature also domesticated conflict. They had certainly good preconditions for war. They had ecological crises, but no signs of war, where in other areas, ecological crises, tons of war. And then it comes to a crashing halt in 3200 B.C., and the area where you can't find one single fortified village, unambiguous fortification for 10,000 years previously, every single area is fortified after 3200 B.C. And what happened? The rise of the pharaohs in Egypt. And Egypt had an extensive colony. It had it for 500 years before this in the southern Levant. But now it was an imperial colony. And the Egyptians put up the first wall, and the people of the southern Levant started building their walls at the same time. And this is another thing that got us to where we are in the world today, that when you get expansionist imperial states, it generates warfare among people all around their peripheries. And the prime example of that has been the expansion of the Euro-American system since the time of Columbus, which has generated warfare among tribals in every continent where they've impinged.
That's a very good place to end. Let me thank the three of you. Douglas Fry is Director of Peace Mediation and Conflict Research at Abo Akademi University in Finland. He's the author of Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace. Darshan Narvaez is Professor of Psychology at the University of Minnesota and co-author of numerous books, including Evolution, Early Experience in Human Development. R. Brian Ferguson is Professor of Anthropology at Rutgers University, and he is author of numerous publications such as Born to Live, Challenging Killer Myths, and Yanomami Warfare, A Political History. Thanks to all who made this program possible: Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week. I can't believe it's been said away.